Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Now being recorded.
Hi, I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Calvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and do our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds, wrap it, and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. And today we will be talking about Sleep No More by Mark Gatiss. And we are going to kick things off with round one, Temporal Grace, in which we say one nice thing about this episode, our favorite thing about this episode. Pat?
Oh, you guys, I don't know if I can narrow it down to just one thing. I mean, I love Sleep No More. When Carrie and I visited New York 2 years ago, we went and saw it at the McKittrick Hotel in Chelsea. And it's this wonderful, immersive theater experience, and every little element of it has just worked out so perfectly. It was just the two of us, Carrie and me, and what they do is they give you these white, faceless masks, and they bring you into this big, converted building. It's all very spooky, and there's fog everywhere, and they let you off on different floors. And you wander around and you look at scenes that actors are performing, and everyone there in the audience is wandering around with you. They are faceless and masked, and they are forbidden to speak. And, of course, you know, it's Sleep No More. It's a version of Macbeth, right? And I'm not going to give away all the details of it or whatever, but you can see things like Banquo's feast, and you can see Lady Macbeth washing the blood off her hands. And if you get tired of it, you can go back to the central area where there's a jazz quartet and a chanteuse singing, and you can have my keys, and then you can take out the mat. Yes, Josh?
I think we watched different episodes, because this is a Doctor Who podcast.
This wasn't an episode. This was a live theatrical performance. They have stuff all over the world. But the one
sounds like you're having an episode, maybe, but we're talking about the Sleep No More Doctor Who by your favorite author, Mark Gatiss, which might explain some of the confusion.
Oh, right. The Doctor Who episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was your favorite part about that one?
I liked those holographic 1950s women who were dressed like the Cordettes. It reminded me of like a Dennis Potter TV show, like the singing detective with lipstick on your collar. Those, I like those ladies.
Good. Calvin?
I have to admit I wasn't aware about this until I was looking up things about the episode, but I like that this was the first Doctor Who episode to have an openly transgender actor.
The Grunt.
So the woman who played the Grunt is transgender.
Oh, okay.
So good for her, you know?
Yeah.
I think the part I enjoyed the most about this episode was the fact that it's the first one-parter, can we call it a one-parter, standalone story in this season, and they still put a pseudo-cliffhanger on it. And I appreciated the cheekiness of that in the context of the entire series. Our enthusiasm is pretty non-contagious.
By, you know, New York play standards, it's really not that expensive.
All right, round two, Doctor in Distress. We take a look at the 12th Doctor in Series 9 and see how his character is developing. So, guys, any observations about Capaldi and number 12 in this one?
Given the sort of narrative conceit of the episode, I'm not sure it says anything whatsoever about the Doctor's character, because I'm not convinced anything in this story actually happened. I don't know. I'm not convinced the Doctor was ever on this space station. I have this theory that that it's like Rasmussen found some old file about the Doctor and Clara and kind of edited it into his video fraud thing that he's doing to give it a weird kind of verisimilitude. Because I don't think anything in this episode actually happened.
Well,
it's like a non-canonical episode, which I think may say something about my general opinion of it.
Well, so we're getting into round four territory, but I want to follow through on this because I think Kelvin's right about it. I don't necessarily agree with you, Kelvin, that it never happened, that it's non-canonical, although that's a really fun headcanon thing that you just did, that this guy stitched his own Doctor Who episode together out of, like, found footage of random other people running around the ship. But it does invite that sort of speculation because it comments on its own the materiality of its own fiction, right? They talk about the cameras that aren't actually helmet cameras. And I did notice that, by the way. I was saying to myself that, oh, well, he can't really be talking to Clara right now, even though he's directing it directly at her and through her into the audience because she doesn't have a camera. At first, I thought this was my level of distrust in the episode. I just thought that it was sloppiness. And then I realized that they were making a metatextual point out of it, although I can't, for the life of me, really understand what that point was. You could have done exactly the same episode if they had helmet cameras and CCTV cameras everywhere, right? It would have made no difference whatsoever, except that now we have the dust being the cameras, and I don't know that that makes any... It seems to be kind of like a nasty postmodern commentary on the arbitrariness of genre conventions, because you have all of these action movie beats, like the grunt sacrificing himself to make all the conventional point about bigotry, but that doesn't make any difference in terms of the overall narrative, because the guy he saves dies a few minutes later without doing anything else. You know, it's just,
right.
It's like Mark Gatiss is saying something along the lines of, everything we ever watch, any kind of show or movie, is just arbitrarily constructed in the plot elements that we observe and in the manner that we observe them too, and then our bespectacled bad guy specifically talks to the audience, oh, you've probably guessed that I'm not dead, you know, don't ever watch this, and oh, at the end there's a sting that this is some type of virus that's going to infect you or whatever. It's all, like Kelvin says, it's stage managed. It might well be a fictional construction within a fictional construction, but I don't really see what point there is to it except to just kind of play around with these ideas, right? It might as well be...
Yeah.
Somebody's fan fiction in the Doctor Who universe, right? His YouTube video that this guy made for all the point it has.
Well, here's my comment. I did find it refreshing that compared to Gatiss's last effort, Robot of Sherwood, it did feel to me as if he was riding for this Doctor. Robot of Sherwood just reeked of the episode that was left over from Matt Smith, the spoon fight and his competitiveness with Robin Hood. None of it seemed to fit very well with Capaldi or even the little bit of the 12th Doctor we had seen that early in the season. So here, I think there's some nice moments with the 12th Doctor that feel like Gatiss actually paid attention to what was going on. One moment that pops to mind is the bit where the captain of the rescue crew mentions that they have no cameras on their helmets, and it just passes by, and the Doctor goes on for another couple minutes before coming back around and registering that comment. And there are a couple other little moments. I will say the other enjoyable thing about Capaldi and the 12th Doctor in this episode for me is that he has that mesmerizing line face. So this whole camera convention to see Capaldi sticking his face in the camera over and over again and glaring into it or looking inquisitively in it, I found that alone, throw the script out the window, highly entertaining. So more of Capaldi just staring intently into cameras, and I'll be happy.
Josh, you are a very warm, compassionate person. I don't think I tell you this often enough.
Round three, friends and foes. We're going to take a look at the bad guys and the not bad guys in this particular story. Any interesting observations about Clara in this episode, or as we've mentioned in the other rounds, that this episode seems to be more about the found footage shtick and not very character-focused?
Yeah, there's just no characterization here that in particular I could pick up on at all. I mean, Rasmussen isn't that distinctive in any particular way. I mean, the closest to an outright real character is the grunt, and the grunt is manufactured to have, like, lower intelligence, and she talks funny. You know?
She's definitely who you have the most sympathy for in that crew.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think they really end up doing much with it.
No,
her
they don't.
Sympathy, but you like her. Gaddis is playing with these conventions. The narrator says, don't get attached to any of these guys at the top of the show. So it's a weird thing where if the author pretty much announces that these are going to be quick stereotypes to get killed off, I don't know if just announcing it or forgive that fact.
I don't forgive that fact.
Well, I know that doesn't.
I certainly don't. I just.
But it at least expresses his intent at the top is that he's not going to really do much with these characters. They are sleep monster fodder from the get-go. I mean, it's just explicitly said.
Yeah, and that's why I think it is, or it could be in better hands, a real bitter commentary on the whole idea of watching fiction at all. You know, is there imaginary people? It doesn't matter if they live or die, and they can live or die in the most arbitrarily conventional way as possible, and or not, or we could kill them off in clever ways, and it really doesn't matter, because on the spectrum of good or bad fiction, it's all made-up stuff about people who don't matter as a way to waste 42 minutes of your weekend night, right? I mean, and that's a point of view that somebody other than Mark Gatiss could express in some extremely bitter way. I don't know, a Neil LaBute movie or a Samuel Beckett play or something like that, right? It could really, you know, cut to the heart of what we mean when we watch fiction at all. And I guess this is where my mind goes when I see people mocking their own stories and saying that my characters are superficial and their drama is unfortunate and all I've done is develop something that's going to entertain you for long enough for this virus to infect your brain. I kind of respect that on some level. I just because none of it was enjoyable on at all, or told me anything more about the human condition. I liked the Sandman a little bit. Yeah,
I liked the Sandman a lot.
Again, it's kind of like the Moon Dragon, where I just couldn't buy the fundamental premise of what they were. I mean, they're things that grew out of eye boogers. I mean, like. What? You know, like, I mean, that's not even, you know, conservation of mass! Okay, that's just all I want to say about that. I mean, I can buy it with the Incredible Hulk. Where does Bruce Banner get, like, a 1,000 pounds of extra mass from when he turns into the Hulk? And it's like, for some reason, I can accept that context, but I could not. It was just way too bizarre, and I think it was just because Mark Gatiss, in place of anything that could be called a theme, just decided to have things be sand-related all the time. You know, they don't even really seem like eye boogers. I mean, they are literally like walking piles of sand, and then there's the holographic women singing Mr. Sandman, and, you know, it's just, you know, sand, because I guess that ties it together somehow. But
yeah, I'm with you, Colette. I sort of like the childishly gross idea about the Sandman, that they are just, it's not, but it's really just a descriptive grossness. There isn't anything on screen that, they're just sand, like you said. They act like sand. They fall apart like sand. It's a concept that demands somebody like Clive Barker writing it, not Mark Gatiss, right? You need like full-on disgusting body horror stuff and horrible sexual acts and things like that to do justice to the concept of that. You can't just have them be desert sand, beach sand that falls apart.
Yeah, beach sand that walks around, yeah. I mean, you know, I get the sort of nostalgia of, oh, it's just good old-fashioned, slow-moving, lumbering monsters, you know. I mean, I'm not against that basic thing. I just thought they tried some kind of weird explanation for why they're there. I mean, like I don't know why, like, they didn't just say they're psychic, you know, projections or some kind of side effect from the Morpheus pods.
Yeah, and
you know, why couldn't they just say that? Why did they have to say they were, like, actual physical things that were grown? I don't know. It was like weird.
They're less monsters than they are a kind of embodied moral scolding, right? They arise out of, oh, well, it's unnatural that human beings don't sleep because they want to work all the time. And so it arises, it generates these monsters that go around and they kill people or whatever. It's very old-fashioned kind of man shouldn't screw around with the natural processes of the human condition or whatever, right? Again, it's the sort of arbitrary fictional construct that...
This is Mark Gatiss' favorite kind of classic Who, though. In some ways, this is trying to tell it in a very unconventional way, but this is very much like the Green Death, that kind of very simplistic, like, it, you know, we're destroying the environment and we've got radioactive maggots and we're getting rid of sleep so the sleep in our eye comes alive. We're wearing socks too much, so we're going to have toe jam monsters. You know, it's like kind of...
I would rather see toe jam monsters.
You know? Well, yeah, they're all sorts of... Now we are opening the door to all sorts of strange bodily things that could become monsters.
Now we've got the planet monsters.
Oh, the planet, you know, foreskin to fight the smegma monsters. That's what I'm looking forward to. But I will say this, separating from the justification of their existence within the story, I enjoyed visually the creepy men in suits off in the distance and not being shot very clearly, and the sound effects. I thought they accomplished some eeriness on a pure directorial visual level, and I enjoyed the wrong word, but I like the big weird sagging open mouths. They kind of remind me of those Sesame Street monsters, actually, from our childhood. Yep,
yeah. Yeah, it's a classic ghost ghoul sort of look.
Mm-hmm. I will say that the sort of simple justification of them is just, oh, they're monsters that sprung from the sleep in your eye. Yes, it has this moral dimension, but it also connects to what I think Moffat, in a big picture, each series that he has been in charge of, I feel, has become more and more fairy tale-esque. This felt like the Brothers Grimm to me, almost. They gave it this very surfacey science fiction idea. I mean, evolving. It's the modern version of the 50s, like Radiation Monster. So it has this very surface science fiction element to it, but really it's more of a dark fairy tale.
Yeah, Josh, you really do have such a big heart. It's...
It's so weird to be, like, the episode that Josh likes at least slightly better than me and Pat do, because I don't think that's ever happened before.
Kelvin, you're usually the old sentimentalist. You're the one that's, you know, really open to experience and not destroyed by life.
Round four, the big picture, in which we talk about whether this thing worked in the big picture. I think listeners may have as to what our opinion is. Shh, don't give it away. Oh, actually, this is the round. So what do you guys think of this episode overall? Let's start with Calvin.
I pretty thoroughly hated it. Well, let me put it this way. I think Robot of Sherwood was a much better episode than this.
Robot of Sherwood
at least had a sense of fun, and there was a base triviality to it where it wasn't trying to be anything profound or deep or anything. It was just sort of a larf, you know. I mean, now don't get me wrong, I would not put Robot of Sherwood in my top 300 Doctor Who stories, but I don't think I would put Sleep the More in my top 400 Doctor Who stories.
Pat?
So, you guys know that I like to go to opera and stuff, right? You know, I'm an opera fan. So there's a sort of thing that happens in opera because people have seen the same stories over and over again, right? You know, opera fans might have seen 50 performances of La Boheme. So there's kind of an escalation of... What are you going to do with La Boheme this time? La Boheme's kind of a bad example, but Wagner's a good one, right? Like, what outrageous thing are you going to do with the ring cycle? And are they going to be underwater, or are they going to be set in World War I, or whatever it's going to do, right? Because the music they can't do anything with, and the libretto they can't do anything with, but they can change the staging a lot. And so in one direction, you get these crazy Eurotrash performances that people like to criticize a lot, and then you have a countervailing tendency where people are like, oh, no, let's do an old traditional thing again. And so you have that kind of back and forth with opera that happens a lot. And I have a point to this. Yes, but what all of those things have in common is that they have a fundamental respect for the source material that they're elaborating on, right? And like the Sleep No More play that I saw with Carrie in New York a few years ago, it was a totally bananas, out of crazy nowhere version of Macbeth, but it still was fundamentally Macbeth. And if you knew the story, you could understand what was going on, and you would have a lifeline through it, and you could see the interesting things that they did because they had a fundamental respect for what the story was. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have things like Mark Gatiss' Sleep No More, which has such a fundamental contempt for the basic qualities of storytelling that it can't even take itself seriously, right? It doesn't even allow you the space to pretend that you care about these characters, because right up front it says, don't get too attached to these guys because they're all going to die. And the only thing that they have going for them is a few character traits and a name that's displayed on the computer readout, and the entire thing is so conventional, and it's such a rehashing of old Doctor Who stuff that the contempt, and it's weird coming from Mark Gatiss, who is such a Doctor Who fanboy, and has been so glowing about it in every interview I've ever read and whatever. It doesn't really seem to have this kind of bitterness at the heart of it, but here it's essentially saying, we don't care about anything that we're doing, and you shouldn't either. Why are you even watching it?
And so you think it's kind of a cynical examination of sensationalism in entertainment? Because, I mean, it says that's what it is. At the end, it says, ha-ha, I gotcha.
No, it's cynicism I actually like, but the execution, I guess, I think is... It has no wit to it. It has no clear point to it. All of these things that I'm saying are things that I've kind of extracted from watching the episode without necessarily knowing whether they're there. Is this all just accidental because it's so incompetently done? Or is it somehow deliberate on Mark Gatiss's part? And I'm imagining these kind of elaborate philosophical constructs around it because that's the only way to make sense of it.
Your thematic criticisms of it are kind of slightly elevating it in my mind. I think you're... I'm listening to you and going, hey, that's kind of cool. What if it did?
Well, you know, I'm Mark Gatiss's biggest supporter. You know,
Well, I will be the bizarre voice of moderation here and say I just thought it was okay. I didn't... make me angry. It didn't. I would not argue this is the best of the season by any means. I will say, I will take a stand like Kelvin did and say, I'd watch this over The Girl Who Lived or Died or which, whatever the hell it was, the first one with the Vikings and the baby who talked. I think it ultimately works on the very shallow, cynical conceit at the end. But I would agree with you 100%, Pat, in that it could have been done with far more wit and flair. But for me, I'm comparing it to other Mark Gatiss episodes, and that might be why I was like, whoa, this isn't too bad. I will take a sort of hoary old cliche horror thing over a really badly done comedy like Robot of Sherwood any day, and that probably speaks more to personal biases than the actual quality. But to me, I thought this was shockingly watchable by Mark Gatiss. And to me, again, it goes back to Capaldi. I will watch him in just about anything, and that's what Doctor Who is to me, is the Doctor. I'm looking for the majority of episodes to be watchable with some really highs and a couple lows. We can talk about this down the road when we talk about the season as a whole, but for me, Peter Capaldi is achieving that sort of almost classic Doctor status for me personally, where it's like, this feels like why I used to watch Doctor Who. It's just, to me, this was a sort of innocuous story in the big picture.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said, because, I mean, there's so much Doctor Who out there in the world that you can do things like legitimately say, I'm comparing this to other Mark Gatiss episodes. And I'm like, yeah, well, okay, if you did that I can see where you're coming from. I'm maybe comparing it to other Peter Capaldi episodes or Stephen Moffat episodes or New Who episodes or the series as a whole. You know, and depending on what your frame of reference is, you can say it's better or worse or you liked it more or less, and I think you could make a solid argument for that. And, yeah, and as you dialed in and you talk about, I watch Doctor Who for the Doctor, and I like Peter Capaldi as the Doctor, then a lot of these other things fall away. And maybe that is kind of my problem, right? Because I agree with you completely. I like Peter Capaldi as one of my favorite doctors. It just kind of, it angers me a little bit that the scripts don't seem to really be up to his standard. And maybe that's my fundamental problem with the last two seasons. I think he's very good, and I don't think that the scripts are. And this was the worst of the scripts as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I would say it's not the worst. I already said that. I don't need to repeat myself. We know what I think was the worst. Talking babies. Speaking in poetry. Babies speak in feces and screams. That's all they speak in.
Somebody was back, there. Josh. You don't have a warm heart.
I don't at all. All right, guys. Should we rate this? Should we shock our listeners with a rating?
I'm giving it one big fat eye booger.
One. Wow. A one.
I was considering giving it 1.5 eye boogers, and a half would be just for, like, Peter Capaldi's performance and the performances of everyone else, because I don't think any of the acting is bad exactly. It's just, I mean, they did what they could with the thinnest characters in a long time.
Can I ask for some context here? We did not rate any individual episodes from Series 8. Can I ask you what you might rate Kill the Moon? Is this lower or higher than Kill the Moon in your estimation?
This is lower than Kill the Moon. I mean, a lot of my reaction to Kill the Moon was just the weird direction it went in, like, the last few minutes of it. Yeah, the Sleep No More was pretty much consistently, I was just not on board with any of it at any point.
All right, Pat?
Well, you know me. I mean, I give Sleep No More 5 enthusiastic stars. It's one of the best theatrical performances I've ever seen. I encourage anybody who's in the New York area to see it as quickly as they can. I mean, it runs all the time. It's totally worth the money. It's one of the best uses of your time. I would go back and see it in a minute.
It's better than Cap.
Oh, yeah.
Better than Rent?
Oh, yeah. You know, Rent is La Boheme, but you knew that.
Better than the Spider-Man musical?
You need to give Doctor Who Sleep No More by Mark Gatiss your favorite.
Right. Okay, so Calvin stole my joke. I was going to say that it got two crusty eyelids and was lucky to have those. But instead, I'll give it two unreadable Jean Baudrillard essays.
You know, I'm still wrestling with the whole rating system in general and how I watch Doctor Who compared to how I watch other TV shows. I think I am a bit unfair to Doctor Who because I'm a Doctor Who nerd. I was thinking about this just today. Like, I watch The Flash, for example. That's a show I love to death. But I'm not critical of it. I couldn't point out what my favorite episode was. I could point out a couple of dumb moments, but overall I forgive it. And it's just, like, I just love watching it every week. And sometimes it's better than others. Sometimes it's not. I don't put each individual episode on trial like we do in a podcast. So
yeah,
we go back and forth on how to really examine and watch this. And I think sometimes I'm more critical of episodes that when push comes to shove, I certainly enjoyed sitting there watching for 42 minutes. I would say I will give it 3 sexy 50s singing girls. Man, you know, it's probably because I'm comparing it to the last Mark Gatiss episode, and it's really hard not to, because those are the glasses I put on before I watch this, is the Robin of Sherwood glasses.
You put them on, and there's like a brrrr sound about arrow hitting a target.
You put them on, and they fart for some inane reason. You don't even know why.
So, Josh, it's time for round 5. This is usually our unfounded speculation, but I hear you have some sort of crazy idea about what we're going to do for our next episode.
I do. We are done with minisodes, guys. Done.
Really? What?
That's madness.
It's the end, but the moment has been prepared for. We are going to do a maxisode. As gross as that sounds, it's okay on the page, but I can't say it out loud. So we're going to have to come up with a different name to say, even though we might call it a maxisode. We're going to cap off Series 9 with one episode that we're going to record live in person about episodes 10, 11, and 12. We've gotten a little behind. I love the idea of these weekly minisodes. A lot of other podcasts do them, and I wanted to kind of be a part of that, and the only way we could make it work was with the recording over the phone. And overall, while I've enjoyed talking to you guys, I miss doing stuff in person. I feel like the sound quality is better, A, and
sure.
B, I feel like we've got a lot more chemistry when we're in person. And since we already fell behind on these minisodes, we might as well get together in person. And plus, these last three episodes are really heavily linked, so it all makes sense. But I've enjoyed focusing on the new series, which is something we haven't really done in our year plus of podcasting.
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I think you're right. We want to get these out in a more timely way. The last three episodes are kind of a trilogy, as I understand it. And sometimes I feel a little restricted just talking about one particular episode of the season. And so being able to talk about the last three as a whole sounds great to me. Also, I think this will give our listeners a chance to chime in a little bit. If you're listening to this, listeners, please contact us either via our Facebook page or getoffmyworldpodcast.com or email us at getoffmyworld@gmail.com and let us know what we might want to talk about in the last maxisode of this season, things that we didn't talk about in season 9, things that you want to hear us talk about.
Until next time, I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying, get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off it.